everybody. Welcome back to the Overrun Podcast. My name is Ed Bowder.
I'm Dan Schwester.
I'm Kevin Mazza.
I'm Anna Ryan.
We are back today to talk about the separation between advanced life support and basic life support. And today we're going to talk about, is there actually a need to separate the two service lines? Now, in the interest of transparency, everyone that's sitting in studio with us today, we're all paramedics, and we were also at one point EMTs.
Hooray!
Yay!
Some of us.
So the basis of this, we're basing this on Senghavi, who's coming out of Chicago in 2015. And the conversation that he had, or the paper that he wrote, and this is coming out of EMS World as well, essentially is discussing that BLS resuscitation and trauma leads to better outcomes. So this paper came out in 2015, and it kind of fomented this conversation of, well, if BLS resuscitation and traumas lead to better outcomes, is there a need for paramedics? So in general, what are our opinions on this? I tend to think that there is a role for paramedics in the pre-hospital environment, but I do think that it's a paradigm that has to shift greatly. And I think that there's a lot of extra things that we can have EMTs do, or have basic life support providers do, that will enhance the practice and kind of improve outcomes. So, Dan, what do you think?
I'm going to tell you that I think common sense beats bad ALS every day, hands down.
Agreed.
If you're doing things for the sake of doing things, if you're ALS skills are not with a goal towards improving patient outcomes, improving the system, I think you're going to, or your training's not up to speed, I think you're going to have bad outcomes. And in that case, you're probably better off being in the back of an ambulance with a basically trained provider who's going to take you to a hospital.
I'm under the impression, and something was taught to me, that you can't have ALS without good BLS, and the system starts from the bottom. And I think the gap between ALS and BLS, particularly in our state, makes the argument for BLS being the primary mode, like the having better outcomes, might be not so true, because the providers in our state don't have the scope that National Registry has, that EMT basics in other states have, and certainly not EMT advanced, intermediate, whatever you want to call them. The question is, like, looking at the study that we're going to talk about, Where is the dividing line? Like, why as advanced practitioners are we having decreased instances of morbidity increases in morbidity and mortality on our patients, having, you know, poorer long term outcomes? I'm looking forward to talking about it.
So and that's another thing that we're going to get to, is in some studies there's actually the implication that the ALS interventions actually decrease outcomes. So we'll get to that in a second.
So I actually think that the care that a BLS provider can give should actually leave more room for more interventions from the ALS side. So right now, at least in New Jersey, what we're doing is basically kind of expanding on what BLS should have already provided for the patient. But at this point, if we're an extension of the ER or wherever else we're going, we should be providing, you know, ultrasound and blood products and, you know, any other, you know, advanced interventions that can cut down the time between a scan and a doctor's interventions, or, you know, anything else, because BLS has already been provided.
So let's talk about that, because that's an interesting thing. One of the things that I think that the advantage of ALS has is as a force multiplier for the emergency departments. We know that emergency departments are way overcrowded. They're used as primary care by a lot of people. When we bring people in that need a lot of stabilization, it tends to cause problems in emergency departments because they have to devote a ton of resources. I think ALS has a role in helping the trajectory of patient care through the system, because a stable patient is an easier managed patient, better able to handle things, better able to get them to definitive care. If we're bringing crashing patients through the front door, there's a lot of people who aren't getting care. There's a lot of people who aren't getting to where they need to be in the system. Just like, you know, if you look at it from the other side, you know, you look at non-emergent transport ambulances, and, you know, people look at that as the bottom of the profession. But let's look at it from the other side. What happens if there's no discharges out of hospitals? Everything backs up.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that speaks to the bigger role that EMS has in general. Like, we started as an extension to the ER, and then we kind of became our own sort of self-contained type of system, where maybe if we change the outlook to, you know what, BLS's job is to get, you know, basic patients to the ER and then to get them out of the ER, and ALS's job is to be an extension of either the trauma department or the emergency department, that might change either patient care or outcomes, and it might actually change the paradigm that we have with EMS in general.
So let's look at this study. It's the Chicago study in 2015. You know, here's what I'm saying. There's a lot of it was a retrospective review. Retrospective
huge
review
too.
But a huge number, about 8 million. And you know, they looked at outcomes for STEMI, out of hospital cardiac arrest, and CVA. So I got some problems here. All of those really are things that we managed that are managed definitively in hospital. STEMI, we know the only thing is get them to a cath lab.
Right.
Okay. And in an urban environment where probably there's a, or a city environment like Chicago, where you could probably throw a baseball and hit a cath lab. You know, diagnostics and, you know, initial treatment is probably not something that's, you know, it probably isn't something that you're not going to see a deflection in outcomes.
Well, we should also mention, too, before we get too deep into this, that there are some pretty significant limitations to the study where the patient population. Now, if they were randomly assigned ambulance transports, which is an important thing when you're looking through a data set. And it went over the course of, I think it was eight or nine years. But also the patients that were in the study were only Medicare patients. So we know that the patients that are involved generally were, you know, elderly population, so they probably had a higher level of comorbidities disproportionate to the regular population. And obviously this only applies to the city of Chicago. It was the only part that was actually analyzed in. So that's part of it. So, and also the way that they're...
But that's a pretty big limitation, Ed. Let's be honest.
If we're only looking at people over
65 years of age who in an urban environment, who may be in an underserved population, who may have a lot of comorbidities, is this really a study that we can take a lot of information from? Yeah, they got 8 million charts. Okay, granted. But what does that mean for somebody out in Western Pennsylvania, where you're an hour from a hospital?
Well, that's why it's important to mention where the study is actually coming from, because we don't want to say that this study is, you know, it's a it applies to everybody. Like, obviously, all studies have limitations, but it's a good place, I think, to start off with, where we say, you know what, there's a certain role that ALS has and that BLS has, and in this particular cohort, it didn't make too much of a difference.
Yeah, I think, just to kind of expound on your point a little further, I think this is just a piece of the puzzle as we start to really look into the difference between ALS and BLS and the actual value of ALS. Like, yeah, you said, possibly underserved population, only in Chicago, only Medicare recipients. This is a piece of a puzzle of the overarching look of ALS and BLS care and whether which one's effective, which one is, you know, excessive. Like, when we think about all the calls we run as ALS providers, how many of them really got anything more than just an IV and a transport to the hospital? Like, did they actually need ALS? Is that person going to have any definitive change in their outcome? Subjects we'll definitely touch on, but I think this is a starting point, like you said. Like, this is a piece to a puzzle or a greater picture that's going to have to evolve and show itself over time.
Yeah, and if you look at the outcomes, I mean, look at the outcomes they study. Okay, STEMI, we know that, yes, there's a role for ALS with, you know, early 12 leads, early activation of cath labs, you know, diverting to the place that's best able to handle a patient. And that's a decision that can be made, you know, by pretty much every entry-level paramedic. Out of hospital cardiac arrest, come on, man. We're not even parsing that data out. I mean, how many of these are witnessed arrests? How many of these meet, you know, the OPALS criteria that we know that if you meet, you know, unwitnessed arrests, PEAA systole on the monitor, no shocks advised, no bystander CPR, that's virtually 100% fatal. So we're in, you know, so you're throwing medics under the bus basically for something that they can't change, that they can't make a difference in an outcome.
Now, it should be mentioned, too, and we didn't mention this. This is actually coming out of the Annals of Internal Medicine as well. This is where the study came from. So, but they did adjust for comorbidities, and they found that the patients did have better outcomes just with BLS in both their adjusted and unadjusted data sets. Now, how in-depth they went into with, you know, the paramedic care and with, you know, asystolic arrest versus VF arrest, I don't know that they actually went too far into those details. But, no, you're right. Having medics involved in any out-of-hospital cardiac arrest study and saying that, well, the outcomes are poor when the medics are involved, well, of course they are. You know, when we're involved in patients who are dead, like, the outcomes are going to be negative overall. But what is interesting is there is data that's, and we'll link this paper if we can find it into the show notes, there is data that supports the idea that paramedics introducing an actual airway, an endotracheal tube, decreases outcomes. which is interesting to me because intubation, endotracheal intubation, is a paramedic skill, but the placement of a supraglottic airway is can be a BLS skill, and that is something that is kind of supported, where use of an SGA over ETI supports better outcomes. So when we talk about BLS has better outcomes than out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, I think that's an interesting place to kind of go, where is are we getting to a point where cardiac arrest is becoming more of a BLS skill? Where, like, because we know that the medications that we give as medics, we know they don't work. So at what point does cardiac arrest become a BLS skill, period?
Well, all right. So let's break that down. Let's talk about the airway. Let's talk about cardiac arrest. We know that there's very little things that show a survival benefit to discharge. And let's be honest, I don't care about ROSC. Okay. I care about survival to discharge. I care about how many people walk out of the hospital with some kind of life, with some type of meaningful existence
and
that they
can
spend.
ROSC is a metric that we created for ourselves. Like
right.
It's a metric, it's a measure, but we do that to make us feel better.
Look, and I fell into the trap too. I was like, okay, what's our ROSC rate? It doesn't matter. What matters is how many people suffer cardiac arrest that are viable, that we get back to the point where they can walk out of the hospital.
Right.
I don't consider an LTAC a victory. I don't consider taking these people up to the ICU where they die 3 days later a victory.
It's the standards of the CPC 1 and 2. Those are the things that you want.
Right.
Right. So, and again, there's nothing that's out there that shows that our interventions at the medic level increase CPC scores.
True.
And it's actual the people who are actually walking out of the hospital. We don't do better by them at the ALS level. So that's what I'm saying. Like, if we know that AEDs work, like, what saves lives in cardiac arrest?
CPR and AEDs.
Yeah. CPR and AEDs, right? And
right.
So now we've got data that supports that BLS can put in a supraglottic airway, whether it's an iGel, which the data on that is turning out to be phenomenal, or an LMA.
Love the iGel.
Right? Like, or an LMA or a King tube. We know that BLS can place that. So
hold on with the King tubes.
Hold on with
the LMAs and the King tubes, because there is some stuff out there. There is some data that seems to suggest that it decreases venous return. It decreases cerebral perfusion. Those are not good things.
No, absolutely. So essentially what you're talking about is the data sets that's out there. Essentially, the King tube has a cuff that inflates, and the manufacturer's recommendations are to inflate it to around 60 cc's of air. And essentially what they're finding is that the inflation in the esophagus of that can put undue pressure on the carotid arteries and on the it reduces venous return to the brain, which is kind of the whole point. So
right.
That's what you're talking about.
There's actually a data set that shows people do better when they're intubated in cardiac arrest, as opposed
to
those
right, which
models.
And that, but that's where the studies get really interesting, is that you have there's information that shows that patients who are intubated have lesser outcomes, and this one particular study showed that, well, the intubation is correlated with, you know, worse outcomes. Now, we know that correlation is not causation, but on the flip side, there's another data set that came out at the same time that showed that patients who were successfully intubated had a better discharge score. So is it that there is a certain amount of patients who were sicker in this one data set? Was the group of paramedics better at intubating in the other data set? But the third variable, which is, I think, kind of the crux to this conversation, is there was another one that came out at the same time that showed that, well, it turns out if you throw in an eye gel, patients survive perfectly fine. So, and that's what I'm saying, is where if we know that CPR and AEDs and, you know, a supraglottic airway like an eye gel actually improve outcomes, at what point do we as paramedics kind of become obsolete?
I think it's at that point, right there.
That's
it. But that's the thing, is that, like, you know, let's look
at
what
cardiac arrest.
Only for cardiac arrest,
right.
We haven't gotten to traumas and all kind of stuff. We'll get there.
But if we look at what it is that the BLS can do at this point, if we hand them an iGel and they have, let's say, like an autopulse or a Lucas device or something like that, they're able to move. They can, and they're doing just fine compressions. So their compressions are
Why
perfect.
Why move?
But that's the thing, is that their compressions are perfect. Their airway is secure. I understand
if
the idea.
It's inserted correctly, if the mechanical CPR device is actually landmarked and placed appropriately.
So then I'll give you eight.
If we don't take 25 to 30 seconds to put the thing on.
So that's then the big point. In theory, then, if I give you an absolutely perfect BLS squad, someone who has they train every day.
Please
and
do.
They are, I would love it. But they train every day, and they are perfectly competent in each one of their pieces of equipment, and they use it to absolute manufacturer standards. If the question is, at what point is ALS obsolete in cardiac arrest? The answer is right there.
Right now.
That's it. Well, their CPR is taken care of. Their airway is secure and we're done.
And I think that's really interesting because there's also stuff, and there's not a huge data set on this, but it supports actually if you elevate the patient's head around 30 degrees, that their cerebral perfusion in cardiac arrest is actually superior. So just based on this, and again, I have a difficult time believing that we're ever going to find this data set because I think it'll be tough to actually execute as a study. But I think theoretically, you could have BLS cardiac arrest be performed with, and again, independently, there's nothing that supports a Lucas device or an auto pulse in improving outcomes versus good hands-on CPR. And I'm not trying to endorse or disendorse. Yeah,
that's very personal.
I'm not trying to criticize a specific product, but those are the two products that are out there: the piston-driven Lucas device and the vest-driven autopulse. Nothing that supports improved outcomes with those devices.
Mm-hmm.
But theoretically, if you have these devices that reduce the workload that the crew has, right? Because now you've got something actually doing the compressions, right? And you have airway maintenance with an eye gel or another supraglottic airway, and you have a decent transport time, and an AED with a defibrillation. Now, again, it only will apply to patients who theoretically are in VFib,
right?
Because those patients will have the higher outcomes. So I'm interested to think, like, in this thought experiment, do those patients all have better outcomes in the absence of ALS intervention for cardiac arrest?
You might be right, but let me throw another wrinkle in.
I love wrinkles.
Let's talk about the ALS provider and what they're bringing to bear. Are you bringing an ALS provider that is, are we talking about tools or are we talking about knowledge? Knowledge and understanding. That's a huge variable. If you're in an ALS program and you're basically EMTIs, if you're calling your medic, if you're calling EMT intermediates medics, and you've given them a basic skills, a very small, narrow skill set, and you're not training them up to the level of medicine that they should be getting. Yeah, I can see where you're not much better than BLS. You're absolutely right. But take it from the other side. A highly trained clinician with a deep understanding of resuscitation science and the ability to lead a team and the ability to manage the event, that automatically, that skill set now becomes very, very valuable, especially in the viable patient. I'm not worried about, like I said, we're not worried about ROSC, so we get him back, okay? But we also lose a lot of people. We also have a lot of people who re-arrest. You need some real knowledge and some management skills to get somebody through that immediate post-arrest period. It's not just about throwing them in the back of the truck and driving.
So, but how many of those medics are true? And see, and we're going to talk about like how much of this is our own ego a little bit later, but
a lot of it's ego.
So, but how many of our medics can we say are true resuscitationists?
Zero, because they go on to do something else. They are so learning driven that, and unfortunately, this is about that career mobility thing that we talked about before. But this is my same theory that applies to EMTs, and particularly volunteers in the area. Every time you find a good EMT, less than a year later, they've gone to do something else. They've become a nurse, doctor, paramedic. And the same problem applies to paramedics because it's not a true career path. So they need to expand. These people have a hunger to learn. They go on to become doctors, become resuscitationists,
right,
and work in ICUs and ERs. We lose these people because there isn't really – it might be a little too niche for a paramedic right now in the given system. In the future, in a utopian EMS system, because I think we're getting it a little bit of a hypothetical, yeah, that out-of-hospital resuscitationist expert very well would be invaluable to out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
So let's get into that right now then. We were gonna do this a little bit later, but since this came up, in our minds, what do we think that, I guess, an advanced ALS practitioner looks like, right? What does that entail? Because right now, like, we're talking about cardiac arrest, is that something that involves pre-hospital placement of, like, VV ECMO, or is that something that involves, doing, like, a POCUS type of thing, a pre-hospital ultrasound, point-of-care ultrasound? If we are going to work as resuscitationists, and we can talk ad infinitum about the career mobility and all that kind of stuff, but what do we think an advanced paramedic looks like in this utopian future that you've purported to us?
A complete ER team.
So instead
you have to somehow bring an entire resuscitationist ability to one or two providers where you do have bedside ultrasound. You do have in the field ECMO available. Like you're talking about these things that will improve long-term outcomes are done in hospital, and the way you have to do it is you have to get them to the patient in a out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Yeah, there are steps. Obviously, bringing an entire resuscitationist team with you to cardiac arrest isn't feasible, but we got to pick and choose the things we can use, get, learn, and practice efficiently to become that out-of-hospital.
So, to your mind, does that involve having a specialized response unit that would be a cardiac arrest trauma type of response unit where you have medics who have X amount of training, whatever we call it, specialized or the critical care or whatever. And so their job is to go to cardiac arrests and to significant traumas and have them as a supplement to your standard crews. Or is this, because I want to talk about things that can be done in the next year, 5 year, 10 year, you know, because in 100 years we'll have flying cars and everything is going to work out perfectly and medicine will be in a pill. So, like, you know, I want to see, like, tangible changes to what we want to do. So, because when I think of resuscitationists in the pre-hospital environment, what I think of is a fly car or an SUV that has all of these things available to it that gets sent out to every cardiac arrest and gets sent out to every significant trauma. That's what happens in my
mind. Why stop there? What about those respiratory calls? What about the high level critical events that, you know, you need somebody to be the brain in the room, to be that leader, to keep everybody on task, to coordinate resources. Than a supervisor, this is a clinical thing, you know,
because there's an operational component to that. So I think you can dispatch cardiac arrest and you know that's coming out to cardiac arrest. So you send the resuscitation team, you know, like a shooting trauma comes out where like the patient didn't have any bullets in them. One thing led to another, and then they had several in them. And then the resuscitation gets sent out to that. Difficulty breathing, I think, is something that's going to be really hard to parse. And I worry that we fall back into that trap of overusing a specialized unit because you get sent out to every 25-year-old asthmatic. You see what I'm saying? Like I feel like that's a very difficult thing to do. So that's why I limit it to those two specific things. Now, it's not to say that this you know, concept couldn't evolve into something else. But that's kind of where I'm going.
But
with
Ed,
that.
The whole concept's going to have to involve. The whole job is going to have to involve. If we're going to, like Kevin said, if we're going to keep our best and brightest in this position, in these jobs, we have got to do something that's going to be meaningful for them and have a benefit to the patients.
So then maybe it's the goal that has to change in the education side of things.
I think the goal has to change for the whole job, for the whole profession.
It's not a goal.
When I started paramedic school, it was very specific to handle the patient in front of you, make sure that you have a positive outcome in your ambulance. There's this big gap between handing it over to a doctor and then the patient walking out, but we're not concerned about that side. It's just we did good here. There's someone who's now pink and breathing in front of a doctor. Hooray for us. But yeah, at what point do we get to look at, you know, the education side being, okay, so let's address this gap. What is it that you want to have happen to your patient in front of you that actually fills this space?
Right. And that's where I think an advanced medic comes in. That right. Advanced paramedic is the big picture thinker, the one who sees the field. We work in an austere environment. We work in a place where we don't have a bunch of tools. We don't have a full ER. We've got our heads, we've got our hands, we've got the people that are with us, and we've got the tools that we carry with us.
Right.
But those tools, we have to take a hard look at what works, what doesn't work. And that's okay. But we have to be very careful about that. We are the only medical profession where everybody tries to limit our scope of practice.
Right.
Okay. If you told a doctor in the emergency department, hey, doc, you know, you only did 2 chest tubes last year. You're not allowed to do chest tubes anymore until you requalify. They would tell you to go get stuffed. And in no uncertain terms, if you told a nurse, I'm sorry, nurse, you haven't worked in the field in X amount of months, so you would be absolutely excoriated. Okay.
Right.
But it seems like everybody can say to a medic, you don't matter. Your stuff doesn't matter. A trained basic person could do that. We could do Uber. We talk about the study, like there's a study in Philadelphia that says trauma patients do better with in the back of a police car than they do with a paramedic unit. My response to that is, what are your paramedics learning? What are you teaching your paramedics?
Well, and the other thing is that I worked in Philadelphia for a while. So the only thing I can speak to that is that's mostly just, you know, availability of units. Because a lot of times what the Philly PD would do is they would just throw a patient in the back and drive right to the hospital as opposed to waiting for an EMS response. Mm-hmm. So and again,
so,
when we
so,
talk about variables,
so
that's,
again,
that's one of those
our
things,
profession's right? suffering because people above them who crunch numbers aren't staffing the units appropriately or putting enough medic units in the area so that they can provide care. So we have to depend on the cops to throw them in the back of a police car. That doesn't help.
Right. And one of the things that and the reality exists, and we, you know, it's something that we've discussed previously and we're not huge fans of, you know, money kind of runs the world. Mm-hmm. So in 2016, Ed Rocht, who's the chief medical officer for AMR, AMR is the largest ambulance company in the United States, essentially put out a series of articles, but he put out a statement that
Kevin's rolling his eyes.
That the separation between ALS and BLS is separating, right? The line is blurring because BLS can do a lot more than ALS could. And one of the things that he was mentioning is that there was a lot of formerly ALS interventions that BLS can perform. Now, specifically, we have Narcan, we have epinephrine, EpiPens, you know, defibrillation, those kind of things. So if money runs everything and we know that BLS is effective, my wonder is, do we put more higher-trained BLS providers in the field and then have sort of, not to say limit our medics, but do we push the medics into a higher level of specialty by default and then overtrain our BLS? Now, again, I don't have an answer to this. This is just, these are all thought experiments, but this is all based on, you know, we know the line is blurring. We know the industry has to move forward, but where does it go from here? Kevin was rolling his eyes earlier, and I want to hear what he has to say.
Well, I wasn't rolling my eyes about AMR or anything particular like that. I think it's a whole culture shift that has to happen. Free hospital EMS has to advance with the science. Keeping it super basic for basics just doesn't cut it because, yeah, you're talking about STEMIs, CVAs, traumas. These are all time-sensitive things. There are many more BLS units available than there are ALS units on any given time in any given place. So if you want to have advanced paramedics, you got to make the basics up closer, maybe like where EMT intermediates are, between IV fluids, basic breathing treatments, you know, CPR devices, whatever. You gotta bring them up to the next level. So if you want to advance paramedics, one, you got to make it a career they can stay in. Two, you got to make this education available. And three, you got to logistically validate the very existence of them. Between going to just, you know, significant traumas at hospital, cardiac arrest, like the frequency of these events and with a unit available within range, like, is that really there? I don't know.
So here's the thing. So what, and let's preface this with that. We don't know what the heck works. We haven't studied. Our profession is probably the most neglectful of all the medical specialties.
We find out every day that we don't know what the hell we're doing with CPR.
Well, we don't, right.
We have no
but
idea.
I'm talking about our profession as a whole. Nobody even knows what works, what doesn't. We don't study anything. We, you know, people, and then we leave ourselves open to people making assumptions based on, like you said, they take a retrospective study of a bunch of Medicare patients and they extrapolate that to an entire nation of providers. Right. What works? Okay.
So is that a lack of initiative on our end, or do you think that's more like an institutional problem where it costs money to do research, and
both.
Also there's risks of, you know, it's that do no harm thing where maybe if we try and pan out this study and changing response models, there's a risk that causes harm to patients.
Both.
Yeah, money. Who's gonna give you the grant money for that study? EMS is not a profitable business.
And that's exactly my point. And this is something that we're trying to change, right? Where if there's we know that outcomes can change, that people can get better, but we can't or won't study them for whatever reason. And that's problematic for us, right?
So what works? What does ALS do really well?
Airways.
Hand down.
Okay, you guys are going to say airways. I can point to probably, I could probably go through data and I could find 100 instances of where ALS didn't do a good job on airways.
I think writ large, we're, especially now with things like, you know, quick clot, TXA, things like that, I think we're fairly decent at trauma. I know we're not as good at cardiac arrest as we like to think we are, but
no,
I think trauma intervention now, and I'm talking about like significant hemorrhagic trauma. I don't think we're good with like long bone fractures. I think that's a BLS thing that can be managed.
Yeah.
But in trauma, I think we're good with pain management. I think we're good with bleeding
some
control.
Places.
No, of course it's somebody. And now, you know, we can't get ketamine or fentanyl in the trucks. So, you know, who knows? But I think writ large, we're fairly good at, like, we're good at pain management. We're good at bleeding control and taking patients to the hospital, which, incidentally, could all be BLS interventions.
Could be.
What do you think we're good at?
I think we're good at the things that we can make an impact on trajectory. I think CHF, COPD, asthma. I think we bring a lot to bear to these patients and we overlook them a lot. you know, we, you know, you get a CHF patient and, you know, they're 220 over 110 and they've got an onset of severe respiratory distress 2 hours and they got rails to the clavicles and they're gasping and they're gray and they look like snot. And all of a sudden, you know, we're in there and we're bombing them with nitrates and we've got them on CPAP and, you know, we're addressing some needs and we know what's going on because we have the knowledge, we know the science, we know what works, we know what doesn't work. And maybe after we get everything else done, we get them calmed down because we might have to give them some ketamine to kind of make them tolerate the CPAP mask. And now we're doing a little bit of a DSI thing where we're giving them some comfort and now they're breathing better. Their sats are coming up, they're drying up, their pressure's coming down. And we drop them off to the ED and, you know, hey, all right, you want to throw a little bit of, you know, 20 Lasix at them while you're doing things. Okay, fine, whatever. Depends on your service, depends on your medical director. You know, it is what it is. And 2 hours later,
that's a super abstract thing too, because it's,
and 2 hours later you go back and they're on a nasal cannula or a venti mask and they're going to the floor. They're going to step down instead of intubated on ICU.
Right. And I'm with you on that. The reason I say that it's super abstract is that now I worry that we're kind of parsing it down to it turns into, you know, like it's knowledge. Because everything you just mentioned, CPAP, nitrates, those are all, and we know that Lasix and, you know, diuretics don't really work as well as we want them to in CHF. So those interventions are all BLS interventions. So it gets back to what Rock was talking about, where the line between ALS and BLS is blurring. Because we know that, like, yeah, ALS can, what we know can change outcomes, but the interventions don't. So I think that's kind of what we're talking about, where is there a reason that BLS providers can't be given that type of knowledge? We're like, hey, this is what works in, say, CHF or COPD.
Yeah, because I think when you're giving your typical BLS provider, let's give them the credit and say it's a 200-hour program. Now let's divide that by 40 hours a week, which is a typical work week in the U.S. That's 5 weeks of training. Mm-hmm. 5 weeks of training to understand complicated physiological parameters, to understand management, to learn how to play chess instead of checkers. That, yeah, you can't do that with a basic service. You can't do that if you're teaching to the lowest common denominator, if you're teaching the basics and just putting them out there. You have to teach, that knowledge that experienced medic's bringing in, the ability to know when somebody needs, you know, that it would be better for the patient if they got some pain management before we moved them, that this is a significant mechanism of injury, and this isn't because here's where the science comes in or here's where the knowledge comes in. The ability to make a determination on what the best facility for that patient is, based on knowledge and understanding. And there's other places that do this. And, I got to meet some medics from the UK. And, I was really interested when we were having the when we'd sit around and have the discussions with them. You know, they put a real emphasis on their education and training, not so much on the toys. They have all that. They have the stuff we have, and they do pretty much some of the things. Well, and I was talking about RSI, and they're like, well, we don't do RSI. Okay, well, that's interesting. But they can choose where that patient goes. They can choose if that person goes to an urgent care, or they can choose whether that person goes to the emergency department or the major trauma center. They can make decisions on patient destinations. They can make decisions on trajectories through the healthcare system and referrals. They can treat and refer.
So is
and that's anything... from the knowledge and the education they get and the oversight they get.
Right, but is there anything that's actually stopping us from doing that on the BLS level?
No.
Right,
not even a little bit.
Right, which is kind of the point, right? This is a program that we can, there's nothing stopping us from expanding it,
right,
or changing, you know,
well, the thing that,
how we teach people.
Like, we can go back to what Dan said about how, you know, we'll give them the gracious, you know, amount of like 200 hours per
5 weeks
class.
People 5 weeks,
that's right. So for a month and a week I'm supposed to entrust my life to somebody, and that's insanity.
Sure.
I think that was fine 15 years ago when it was, you know, oh, we're gonna go to the hospital, I kind of don't feel well. People actually called when they didn't have to worry about insurance or money or anything like that, because, you know, whatever situation they were in, blah blah blah. But if what we're talking about is an evidence-based system, then we're not giving these people who, let's, you know, talk about the fact that these people were like cutting deli meat 3 days ago and now they're supposed to be my clinician. Like that's not this isn't it's not fair. If we're looking at a science-based outcome, we have to give them science-based practice.
So to build off what Dan's kind of saying, when we're talking about blurring a line between ALS and BLS, at that point, it just becomes semantics. We'll be calling it basic life support versus advanced life support because scope keeps
and that's kind
expanding.
Of the bigger point.
Right. So talking about what Dan talked about, 5 weeks, sure, you can teach, you know, as we like to call cookbook medicine, monkey skills, because we're in a 5-week course, you produce a technician. You don't produce a clinician. Clinician comes with education, time, experience. And frankly, the thing that this study shows is that these BLS interventions, technical skills, things that technicians do, improve outcomes. They're not showing that clinical knowledge improves outcomes because, you know, that's kind of a hard metric to measure, right? So, in my opinion, in order to basically save the paramedic, and I put that in air quotes, is instead of being a separate entity from BLS, they need to become more of an entity with the hospital. It has to be more of a continuum of care thing. They have to, you know, mobile intensive care units a complete misnomer, right? We don't do mobile critical care. We're a very light mobile ER.
Yep.
If we can make it an actual more true extension of the ER where we are making these critical clinical decisions that an ER physician might make, but they're not there to be true eyes, ears, hands for the doctor, then I think you can call that your advanced practice paramedic, or you can just call it actual advanced life support.
So let's just call everybody paramedics.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about
this. Why don't we stop this whole technician thing and say, you know what, everybody is a paramedic. Canada does this. The UK does this. Australia does this. Mm-hmm. Everybody's a paramedic, but your practice is dictated by your clinical training, your education, and your knowledge. You can be in the UK and you work your way up the ladder. There are consultant paramedics. They are PhD level people who work in pre-hospital medicine.
We don't have that ladder.
We don't because we never looked for it. We don't because the vast majority of the people that drive the systems don't care about that. It's get them to the hospital, drop them off, go get the next call.
It's no longer a matter of knowledge. Because like you said, in these other countries, their practice is based off of educational merit. But here we're based off of time spent in a classroom. So maybe that's the switch, is that at one point or another, yeah, you can have your 5-week basic class, but then what do you do with it? Are you allowed on an ambulance after that? Can you, you know, spend more time in a hospital? What about rotations in a hospital? Why can't you see what other departments are doing? That kind of thing. So if I'm looking at an advanced paramedic, then it's, you know, I've spent 4,000 hours getting my paramedic in the first place. But then if we're looking at that jump between what my 5-week EMT has done and my 4,000 hour paramedic has done, then we're still looking at time. It's not an educational merit at all.
No, and we have to look at educational merit, and we have to be integrated with the healthcare system.
That'd be nice.
Oh, absolutely.
We have to because you know what? We do improve throughput in the emergency department. We do improve patient trajectories. When we get care to the patient earlier, I would bet that we don't know because nobody's done the study. We probably have a lot of things that we do well on. You know, do I think that somebody shot in the leg needs a paramedic unit? No.
Nope.
If the BLS is trained, if they're doing bleeding control, if they're managing the patient appropriately, no, they don't. But if your BLS isn't doing their job or their technicians aren't doing their job, then you need that person to do the stuff that they should be doing.
Right. And that's in a bigger picture, I think that the conversation that we tend to have, I think, at least anecdotally as medics, is, you know, well, I spent X amount of time to become a paramedic. So I think there's also an issue that we have to kind of check our egos where, like, well, you know, you did 5 weeks, you're an EMT. I did 2 years, I'm a paramedic.
Right.
I think that's something that, if and at a very basic level, if we just change that terminology, like what you're suggesting, Dan, where we say everyone's a medic and then, you know, we can add extra titles or letters to it, I think that at a base level might start changing the paradigm, and then you just kind of shift it up from there.
And maybe we'd stop being called ambulance drivers.
I mean, maybe. I do drive an ambulance.
It's part of the job description.
I don't drive an ambulance.
Neither do I.
Chase cars.
I don't fly. I don't drive an ambulance either.
I fly a helicopter.
You don't drive.
No, I do not drive. I have a chauffeur. We like to call
in our little ambulances. You go in your little aircraft in your little chase car.
But
it is a super complicated topic, and it's not. Obviously, we're not going to solve it today. But we are excited to hear what you guys have to say. Throw it down in the comments. Let us know what you think. Rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Spotify, we're up on now.
Yes.
Also, yes. Google Play and Stitcher. So for the Overrun, also Twitter, Overrun EMS, Facebook and Instagram, Overrun Productions, OverrunProductions.com is the website. We have all the things. We're actually really excited to hear what you guys have to say about this.
Yeah, please interact with us. Tell us tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like.
Tell Danny give us, like his hair.
Wow. Give us ideas. If you want to hear something, you want to hear a discussion, you know, we're going to be bringing on some guests in the near future. There's a lot of things that we're shooting around. This is kind of new in that it's basically a paramedic driven thing here. We're not docs. We're well, not yet. Right, Ed?
One day.
We're medics. We're medics who work in the field. So you want to have that discussion? Let's get some ideas out there from EMS world, the EMS land.
Yeah, that's the whole point where what we're doing. It's by EMS providers for EMS providers. So for the Overrun, I'm Ed Bowder.
I'm Dan.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Anna.
And we will talk to you next time.
Bye.
Get home safe.